All right, here we go. Ready for another bonus episode of Oh My Word Podcast. And today, drum roll please, or wait for the build up. We have a special, special guest. And that is, wait for it, Marlene Perez. Thank you so much for joining us. YA author Marlene, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and we're very excited. So just to tell the listeners, just for one second, we are talking to Marlene because she is an author, and she's going to have some amazing stuff to tell us, I'm sure. Also, she has a book coming out, not her first book because she has many books, but a new one is coming out very soon. I think it's next month, and it's called The Afterlife of the Party. So that'll be something for everyone to look up after you hear how amazing she is. So now that we did that little plug, and we'll talk more about that later, but now that we put that little plug in, let's get right into it. Marlene, if you would please share with us, how on earth did you become an author? How did we get to this point? Short or long answer?
That is a long, long story, but the most important thing is that I have always been a reader. I think that it doesn't matter what else happens in your life, but if you were a reader, you understand story and you have a love of words. And that's really what matters as a writer. Unfortunately, when you're in high school and you're getting ready to go to college and you're talking to your guidance counselor, they do not tell you, hey, you are such a good writer. Why don't you pursue that professionally? And honestly, if there are any guidance counselors out there, I really wish you would. I wish that you would find those kids who love writing, love reading, and really want to share words and share their stories. I wish that people would encourage that. But unfortunately, the arts are not encouraged as much as, you know, more traditional careers are.
Yes.
So that's how I got started. I've always written. I've always had some great high school teachers. I had some great college professors. But then it was one of those things where I'm like, one day I'm going to write a novel. And that's the other thing that I'll tell everyone. Go toward the fear. It's very scary to put yourself out there and to start your first novel or your first short story. Or if you're an artist, an illustrator, it's the same exact thing. It's like that fear of the unknown, the fear of rejection, the fear of failing, all of those things kind of hold people back. So in my case, I started out writing for educational publishers. I did that while I was doing other sorts of writing. Huh. I was volunteering at SCBWI for the local chapter a lot. I used to volunteer and do the schmoozes back when they were called that, and sit meetups.
Yeah.
And then I did a work for hire book with Wizards of the Coast. I don't know if there are any Dungeons and Dragons fans out there, but it was a book set in the Dungeons and Dragons world, but it was for mid-grade readers. And shortly after that, I heard Norma Fox Mazur speaking at SCBWI Nationals, and she spoke about, you know, that terrible editor in your head.
Yeah.
So she would put a fedora over her head, and she would sit at her typewriter, and she would just type and type and type and type. And then she would, you know, take the fedora off, she would read what she'd written, and then she would, you know, fix it and then keep going. And 6 months after I heard Norma Fox Mazur speak, I had written my first novel, the first novel I finished.
Like, oh, wow.
I had, you know, false starts, but not completely finished. And that manuscript became my first published novel, which was called Unexpected Development. And that was with Roaring Brook Press. And I think that came out in 2006. I'm pretty sure it did. And here is maybe a bit that people don't hear very often, but before my novel came out, the parent company of Roaring Brook Press went bankrupt.
Oh man. Oh no.
Oh no is right. Yeah. And they ended up, so my novel was delayed. No, I didn't know what was gonna happen. They sold Roaring Brook to I believe it's Macmillan. And my novel, you know, came out with Roaring Brook Press. But then the other thing that happened was my editor at the time was told by Barnes & Noble to change the cover. I don't know if people realize that authors don't usually have a lot of say in their covers. And my cover was a little much for the teen audience. And Barnes & Noble told my editor, hey, if you change the cover, we'll buy 8,000 more copies.
Oh, wow.
Right. And the thing is that depending on the company and depending on the editor, you may or may not find this out. And in my case, I was at ALA, American Library Association. I was at the conference and I was talking to an agent, not my agent, just an agent, you know, in conversation. And he told me.
Oh my.
My agent didn't tell me. My editor didn't tell me. I found out on the street, so to speak.
Oh, man.
So anyway, that was my first agent. He's no longer my agent. I have a different agent now.
Yeah.
So that was the first book that came out. And then I think I just wanted to add that maybe people also don't realize that after your first book comes out, you want to have a second book ready, right?
Yep.
Or at least in development.
Yep.
Because they don't want you for just one book. Like honestly, like they want their authors. They want to keep those authors, and they want to keep publishing. And so, the more you write, and the more you keep writing, even if you're pre-published, if you're not even actively submitting yet, that kind of gives you a little bit of breathing room once your first book is published.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point to say it's also the breathing room, because I mean, if I like an author, I'm going to go see if they have more books. So
exactly.
But
exactly.
The breathing room is from the author's perspective of you don't now have to rush another book because you're already working on something else.
Well, and also it just is really good to, if you only have one project, all of your hopes and dreams and fears are kind of wrapped up into that one book.
Right.
And let's face it, everybody gets rejected. That my favorite saying is from my old critique partner, Terry Miller Shannon, and she would always say, real writers get rejected.
Yeah.
And I love that because it's the truth. I don't know of very many. Maybe there are authors out there, and if they are, they've been very, very lucky. But I don't know of any author who is a published author who hasn't had their work rejected at some time.
Right, right.
And so I'm not saying to just, like, you know, throw your work out there before it's ready, but I'm just saying that there's a point where it is ready and you have to put yourself out there and you have to try, even though it's really scary. And, you know, you do get rejected. I've been rejected so many times. I can't even count how many times I've been rejected. I don't even count it anymore.
Right.
Because
right.
That's just part of the business, because writing is subjective and stories are subjective. It's just like when you pick a book to read, you are drawn to a book for a reason. Well, editors are like that too. They're drawn to a book for a reason.
Oh, that's so yeah. That is such a good point. That's so true. Actually, I want to follow up on what you said, because you mentioned this whole thing with the guidance counselors. Are you saying, did your guidance counselor try to dissuade you from writing that you brought that up, or are you just saying it as a general thing?
I do. Yeah. I really think that that society, and not just my guidance counselor, but my guidance counselor was like, hey, get an accounting degree.
Oh, yeah, well, because it has a steadier paycheck.
Yes, but there's this really great book, and I'll probably mangle the title, okay. But I think it's called either Finding Your Own North Star or Follow Your Own North Star by Martha Beck.
Okay.
And I really, really recommend it for creative people because it talks about how society kind of tells us what we should do and what's practical, but that might not be the right move for us. And that's why we might be really, really deeply unhappy because we're not fulfilled in our careers. We're taking that accounting degree when we really want to write a novel.
Right.
So anyway, that's kind of my theory. And, you know, I have four kids and, two of them are too young to have gone through the guidance counselor process, but the older two definitely have.
Right.
And my oldest daughter is in a creative career and just as bad as writing. She's in film.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah.
And so, you know, it wasn't like people were saying to her, hey, you know, the film industry is a really good gig. Go for it. So
right.
I just think that I wish that we had a wider definition of what would be a good career to follow, because it seems like everyone thinks that, A, either you shouldn't make money at art, which I disagree with.
Right. Yeah.
Or B, you can't make money with art, which I also disagree with. So that's it in a nutshell, mine. Issue.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And it's, I'm just gonna throw back, we had on someone a couple weeks ago, his name was Michael Levin, and he said that when he first started off in his career, he had someone who sat down with him and said, okay, what do you have to do to make enough money to be able to sustain your career, and like, how can you make that happen? So he started teaching classes and writing or things like that in order so that he could be a writer, and it was still all within his world, instead of get that accounting degree, which would go like contrary to the way his brain worked. So I guess that's something we have to start thinking about also, is how can you sustain it within your world?
Exactly. And I just think that there are all sorts of ways to be happy, and maybe we should think about it a little bit more than just kind of, you know, encouraging one thing.
Yeah.
The practical.
Yeah.
Only.
Right. And writers should get raises. Yeah. I don't know if you were saying that, but I just understood that now. Yeah. So also one more question, that when you speak about the Dungeons and Dragon book that you were working on, was that something that you got because you had, were you working with an agent at the time, or is that something that you were able to do that you got through some sort of other connections or querying or something?
It was actually through someone in my critique group.
Oh.
And we just heard about it, and I can't even remember where I met the editor, probably at an event, but I met the editor, and with work for hire stuff, you know, you have to make the decision about that, because usually work for hire is a flat rate.
Right.
And it just depends if it's right for you or not. I know of a lot of people who have been really successful with it, and they understand what they're getting into with that. And so you just have to kind of figure it out. And I've always liked Dungeons and Dragons, and I've always, you know, liked that world. So I decided that, yes, it was worth it. And I think I did have an agent at the time that I actually wrote the books, but he didn't bring that to me.
Well, oh, okay. Right. Okay. Okay. So I guess
that, and then after the Dungeons and Dragons book, so I wrote, so then I didn't have, I separated with my first agent. I no longer had an agent. I was searching for a new agent. I had an idea. I have an eight book younger teen paranormal mystery series.
Wow.
With Houghton Mifflin Harcourt called the Dead Is series. And so they, all the titles have Dead Is in the title.
Oh yeah, I saw those. Yeah.
And when I was looking for a new agent, I had a full manuscript of, it was called Cupid in the Corner Pocket at the time. And I had a, just an idea, basically a chapter and a outline of the first book of Dead Is. And I sent that to him. And so my current agent is Stephen Barbara, and he was a very new young agent at the time, and I was newer and younger as well.
Right.
And we just kind of hit it off. He really liked my manuscript. I had, at the time, I had submitted Dead Is the New Black, the first chapter for the Orange County, what was it called? Editor's Day. I think it was called Editor's Day back then.
Right.
With when Francesca Roussakis and Q.L. Pierce were the RAs. I submitted that manuscript for critique. And Abby McAden from Scholastic was one of the readers. So all of this stuff is happening all at once. I'm looking for a new agent. I'm submitting, you know, this manuscript for critique at SCBWI, the local chapter. And I got an agent. I got Stephen Barber as my agent. We made it official. He started submitting Dead Is. Dead Is went to auction.
Oh, wow.
The day before the conference, which was my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday. Oh, yeah.
It sold to, it was Hardcourt only at the time. It sold to Hardcourt. The next day I met Abby, who had read it in manuscript, and she and I just hit it off. We got along so well. We had that conference. And so this is the other advice I will give. I'm not too sure who's listening, but if you can and you can afford it and you are able time-wise, and obviously not right now when we're socially distancing, but in the normal world, if you can go to a conference and interact directly with a editor, it's really good because you get to get a feel of that editor's personality, especially since we live on the West Coast.
Right.
And we don't really see editors as often. A lot of them are, you know, obviously in New York City. And it just, I think that you are so eager when you're first on that path to publication to get an editor. You don't really think about whether it's a good fit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that if you can kind of like see how they are and how they act and what makes them laugh or what makes them tick, you can really get a good feel for that.
Right.
So I ended up doing two books with Abby, and I also had a three-book contract with Hardcourt. This all happened kind of all at once.
Wow.
And then I found out I was pregnant with twins.
Oh, wow. Yes, everything at the same time. Yes.
Yeah, so I think 2008 to like 2015 was pretty much a blur.
Yeah.
Because I wrote two books for Scholastic and eight books for Houghton Mifflin Harcourt for the Dead Is series, and I wrote three adult urban fantasies for Orbit Books, which is an adult science fiction and fantasy
imprint. Wow.
So that was a lot.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. And so, but one of the things I was going to point out is I did during that time, after Harcourt bought the Dead Is trilogy, at the time it was going to be just a trilogy.
Oh, wow.
They merged with Houghton Mifflin. So first I had a bankruptcy and then I had a merger. And oftentimes in mergers, there are layoffs, right? There's staff layoffs, there's changes. And so I did kind of live through all of that, but I was fortunate that I wasn't orphaned. I stayed with my same editor through all eight of those books with Hooten von Harcourt.
Oh, yeah.
So then I took a little hiatus from 2015 till now. And now The Afterlife of the Party is coming out.
Woohoo! So
did I answer most of your questions?
I don't even know, because what you're saying is just so interesting. So I don't even remember what I was asking anymore. So, because this is like, I don't think people realize that the stuff, like what can be happening. So, also just that you mentioned it, I wonder if this connects also to what you're saying with Barnes & Noble and your cover. So what's the difference between a lower YA, or like you said, The Afterlife of the Party now is going to be an upper YA. How would you distinguish? Because YA should be teens. It's 14 to, 17, 18, or 12 to 18. You know, so what is that?
I think that is kind of the difference, is that in general, they say like 14 to 17 is the older YA. And then like sixth grade to ninth grade is the younger YA.
Okay.
And I'm really not fond of the term clean reads, because it's that kind of implies that others are not clean.
Right.
Maybe sweet reads. I don't even know what I like for the young, maybe just younger teen, but that's pretty broad. I think that maybe it's the age of the protagonist could be one of the ways that they decide, but in the end, it's really a marketing tool, right? Like
right.
That is the way that we signal to the gatekeepers who will be purchasing books. I don't know many sixth graders who have a lot of spare change to be buying books. So it's usually their parents or, the librarian who provides those books for them. Or really cool aunts, I don't know, cool uncles.
Yeah.
But so I think that it's kind of, in a way, you don't have to worry about it too much. You just should, kind of be aware of those books and make sure that you read into those categories, because there is nothing on earth that I dislike more than an author who is new on the scene and is so unaware of the history that came before.
Okay.
Suddenly there's like, a contemporary YA author who thinks that he has invented contemporary YA.
Right.
No, that is not, there is a complete history of children's literature, and just being aware of it and not, or like, oh, I wrote this book because there weren't any, books about fairies.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Good luck with that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's really like, I don't read. So right now I'm writing the second book in the Afterlife trilogy. And so it's vampire, snarky teen vampire YA.
Right.
So I am not reading vampire novels right now.
Oh,
but
okay.
When I'm finished, I will read the heck out of those novels. So right now I'm reading historical mysteries, or, maybe some fantasy, or maybe a little romance. I still read. I just try to not, I just don't want things to kind of bleed into my work.
Yeah.
And so I try to stay away from the category that I'm writing at the time.
Oh, you just answered a question that I didn't even ask yet. So that's good. So I was going to ask what you're reading. So there you go. But just to return for one second, as you're writing it, and you have that, you do have your quote unquote, your lower YA versus your upper YA, from the writer's perspective, do you feel like there's something different, either aside from the age of your protagonist, either in regard to what you're willing to cover or what you're willing to write about, or either words or scenes or whatever that you're willing to put in? Or do you just feel like you're writing it and then you let them categorize it for you?
My best advice is to not even worry about that.
Right.
Because, well, first of all, you have to go through the whole editorial process and what you start with. is not what you end up with.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That is true, yeah.
And secondly, you should not ever try to, I don't want to say censor your style, but write it the way you want to write it, and then you can always make edits and adjustments if you, you know, if you start to get feedback, like from your critique group or your, you shop it, you start submitting it, and you're like, hey, those 11-year-olds really shouldn't be doing X, Y, Z, right?
Yeah, right.
Then you can kind of modify as you go. But I think the most important thing is to tell the story first, and really worrying about the classification is, like, I never worry about it. It's like somebody will tell me what they think it is.
Right.
When it's on its way to the shelf, then you'll know, because it'll say right on there. So that, but that's just my opinion. I'm not a teacher. I'm just a writer. And so in my opinion, you write the book and you write what you want to write and you say what you want to say in that book. And then you go on from that. I will say with, YA and mid grade, you have to be careful that your characters don't sound either too old or too young, or
right,
unless you're writing a historical novel. But I also think that you shouldn't worry too much about slang. Like, I try to avoid slang because it's so...
It dates it.
Yes, it dates it. And then the other thing is that it changes so quickly. The language of slang changes so quickly. And see, the same way with technology particularly teens. You know what? I mean, I think I picked up a book a while ago and it used the word BlackBerry or pagers. I mean,
right.
That was what was probably happening when that book was written. And there's a certain amount of it you can't avoid because you have to acknowledge that technology exists.
Exactly.
But I think that if you worry about it too much and you, like, if you're like looking to see what teens say today about a phrase that they use, they probably won't be using that next week.
That is really, really good advice, because I think so many people do worry about sounding so much like a teen, and it's not about, or I would think it's not about sounding like a teen so much as writing stuff that's relevant to teens or that a teen can relate to. So,
right, and you definitely don't want to sound like somebody's cranky old grandfather. You know? But I think there is this, I think it's a misconception. But this, especially in YA, that somehow, and I have children in their 20s, and I have children who are preteen. And there's this misconception that 25-year-olds are somehow closer to teens.
Right.
But that was a moment in time that was, like, let's say 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the same moment in time. And it would be like saying that only 8-year-olds can write about 8-year-olds.
Right.
Or
right.
The only picture books that should be written should be by, you know, infants and toddlers.
Yeah.
So I that is the only thing that I see that sometimes is an issue in writing for teens. I think that as long as you keep your self open and trying to learn new things and definitely respect the people that you're writing for, that you that's more important than any kind of youth, because youth is fleeting and
right.
It only lasts for a minute, right? Like
right.
And the kids, my 12-year-olds, I have two 12-year-olds and I have some two 20-somethings, and their experiences are completely different.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So now just to skip ahead a little bit. Oh, running out of time. Okay, we'll go a little over. But all your books, or I think almost all your books for teens are paranormal. right? Or they'll have some sort of vampire or something.
Almost all of my books, but not all of them. The books I wrote for Scholastic are like romantic comedies.
Okay.
I have two books with Scholastic that are romantic comedies. But the majority of my books are urban fantasy or paranormal.
Okay.
And the trilogy that's coming out in September, the first book is a snarky teen vampire, but they are the vampires. We are stabbing vampires. We are not making out with vampires.
Oh, very good. So that's actually, I guess this is a dual question. You could either answer either part of it, or if there's an answer that will be for both. Number one, how do you get into vampire? Like, how did you get into vampires? And number two, did Twilight have anything to do with either the success of the genre, or is it something you get a lot, that you hear a lot about, or is it something that I wish that hadn't come out, because everyone has a misconception about vampire novels, or what's,
well,
it's kind of a mush.
It kind of goes back to the, like, nobody invented the genre.
Right.
Although I think that Stephanie Meyer absolutely, and Twilight absolutely did a lot for the genre. However, Anne Rice,
right.
You know, there's a million other vampire writers
right.
of vampire fiction.
Right.
Charlene Harris, who wrote the Suki Stackhouse series, which became True Blood. I was back in 2008 or 2009 at the height of the Twilight craze.
Yeah.
I was on a panel, a paranormal panel, and the question actually similarly came up, and the woman sitting next to me said, I've been writing vampire novels for 30 years and I'll be writing them for 30 more after Twilight has, you know.
Yeah.
But for teen vampire novels, I definitely think that its effect cannot be minimized. I think it was really it did a great it opened a lot of doors for other writers of paranormal fiction.
Yeah, I once saw an article that the biggest contribution that Twilight made, and I don't remember the article because I wish I could relook it up again, was it basically proved that teen fiction can also be a big moneymaker, which does open up the industry now for people being more open to it, right? To saying, that you see a massive increase in the genre since then. Not just in paranormal, but also for YA, which is obviously amazing, because the more we can cater to our age group, the better it is for the age group and for us.
Yeah,
so,
and I just think I like vampires.
Yeah, oh, okay, there you go.
I like vampire movies. I watch What We Do in the Shadows. I like vampire fiction. I think, honestly, that's the best advice I give to everyone, too, is, like, write what you like.
Right.
You know, if you don't like vampire fiction, don't write it and don't read it. If you do, don't let the fact that Stephanie Meyer has a new book out, right?
Yeah.
Because my book, Afterlife of the Party, is coming out a month after Midnight Sun.
Yeah.
But that was just a weird coincidence. Like, you know, Stephanie Meyer announced it at, like, the last minute that she was done with that novel.
Yes.
And
that
it was coming out.
Yes.
And so nobody really knew. I just like writing vampire fiction. And that's what you do, is you kind of collect these little ideas. So I started my Afterlife of the Party because I'd been reading a lot of news articles about the Me Too movement, and also about Jeffrey Epstein, and it made me, you know, think about predators and consent and things like that. And so sometimes those are the things that are in the world that everybody's kind of reading and thinking about, and that's what inspires someone. And I think that people assumed that the writers who were writing vampire novels at the same time as Stephanie Meyer were inspired by Twilight.
Right.
But I think those writers were inspired probably more by, like, Anne Rice or
right
authors who came before her.
Right.
So
Well,
anyway.
Yeah. Is there the Epstein reason why they're stabbing the vampires instead of making out with them? Does that have something to do with that? You're like, done with the predators, gone with all of them.
I had this really interesting conversation with my friend Melissa Wyatt, who's an author, and my friend Mary Pearson, who's also an author. And we were talking about, you know, the symbolism of vampires and Bram Stoker's vampires and
right.
and how, you know, they he compels them in the original Dracula, and that shift where all of a sudden vampires went from gross old men with
yes.
garlic breath or whatever
yeah.
you know, to this sparkly, handsome vampire who is a love interest.
Right.
And the nature of the original, you know, he takes their blood without their consent and stuff like that. And so that's kind of where I started thinking of it. And yeah, I was mad. Not that I would ever really stab anybody,
yeah.
but like,
yeah.
you know, I'm like, these predators.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a good thing that you brought up Bram Stoker, because is that 200 years already at this point? So that's probably one of the first vampire novels as far as a big, so that's way before Twilight, even though, you know, however old those characters are, but it is way before it. So it just proves that it was always there. And I think a lot of people also don't realize that just because two books are coming out at the same time, that doesn't tell you how much time was spent on the books before that.
Right. And like, I mean, I think of like Dark Shadows, which was in the 60s, maybe.
Right.
And Let the Right One In. And, what's that? Nobody Left Alive. I mean, there's so many vampire, and Dracula's been remade so many times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there have been. I could probably Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is my absolute favorite.
Oh yes, yes.
Yeah, and so there are plenty of things in our popular culture that are about that, and so you know that have a vampire theme. So I think that it's not wrong to credit Stephanie Meyer, but I think there are a lot of other people out there as well.
Yeah, it's. As you said, you gotta when you know the history, then you realize that just because someone's standing out a little bit, it doesn't necessarily make them the first one. Just a lot of things came together for that.
She stood out a lot.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So good for her.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes it's just a matter of certain things coming together at the right time to make that happen. Which I don't know if I should say this, but that's what I say a lot about a book like Harry Potter, that it's still around. It's still a massive thing 20 years later, and people who are real fans of it will say, what makes it better than X other book? And sometimes it's not necessarily something they could describe. It just hit them in a certain way. It's not necessarily because the writing's any better. It's not the first wizard book that's ever been written, but that book just came at the right time. It just landed, a lot of things just came together at the right time for it. And look, at the end of the day, anything that's going to help kids people read more is always good. So
exactly. And
yeah.
you know, I think there are books for everyone and there are readers for everyone. And there is plenty of room for every kind of book. And I think that people can get a little too discouraged. I know sometimes I get a little too discouraged if I hear about a book that sounds a little bit like mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, there's this great quote by Stephen Sondheim that says that what makes it is what makes it better.
Right.
Because it's from you, it changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I've had that. I had that with one of my books. And then when I was describing to someone, they said, oh, blah, blah, blah. Is out. And I was like, wait a second, this book is already out. So I had to go read it to make sure that it wasn't the same book. And
yeah,
it can't be
the same book.
Yeah.
I mean, it can have similarities,
yeah.
but, you know, I mean, I have had a couple ideas that were just so similar, but fortunately I hadn't finished those.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't written, I just kind of had a partial maybe, that were enough that I said, you know what, I'm really not going to invest in this right now. Maybe I'll come back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there are no new ideas under the sun, right? They're
right.
all the ideas.
There's variations, yeah.
Yes, it's just, you know, it's out there, and you should just try to focus on what you want to write. But I mean, you still have to realize that you shouldn't follow the market, but you shouldn't ignore the market.
Oh, yes, that's an excellent way to say that. Yeah. Oh, speaking of market, I think you had mentioned that you have certain things coming up for Afterlife of the Party.
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. So yeah. I did want to mention that we are starting, my publisher is starting a Goodreads giveaway starting on August 7th.
Ooh.
And it runs for the month of August till September 6th. And it's for U.S. only, but you can Google the book, or not Google, but search the book in Goodreads, The Afterlife of the Party by Marlene Perez. And if you want to enter to win a copy, you can. And then in a week or so on Instagram, you can always follow me on Instagram. There will be the cover reveal for book two.
Ooh.
Book two is called I'm with the Band. And book three is called A Sucker for You. And they're doing the cover reveal for both of those books.
Oh, wow.
I'm really excited.
When are those two due
fabulous.
Out? When are the two
books? I'm sorry?
When are the next two books due out? Is it one per year, or is it going to be less time
the
than
next, that? The second book is due out in August of 2021, and I don't have a date yet for the third book.
Ah, so much time. Well, we'll put your website will be in the episode notes. So, and I'm assuming all that information will be on the website, or they'll find you, your Instagram on the website.
Yeah.
So that way
yes,
everyone will be able to find you.
Yes, all of my social media is on a page on my website.
Okay, great. And then also, I always wrap up, even though I don't think we even covered half of everything, but there's so much all the time. So there's nothing to do about it. But I always like to end off with the fill in the blank of, I love it when either writers or publishers, whatever you want to fill in there, do X. And I really can't stand it when they do X. So do you have a fill in the blank for those two lines?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I love it when editors laugh at my jokes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I hate it when they call me on my mistakes, but I love it because I need it.
yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's like when you get the document back with all the corrections the first time, you're like, no, you just want to throw the whole thing away. Yeah, and then you're like, okay, come on, let's get this done. Yeah.
Oh, I have one last tip. This is a tip that another writer friend gave me. When you first get your editorial letter, you know, read it over, take a break, but then do the easiest thing first, the smallest thing, because otherwise those editorial letters, you know, or the you know, edits in the body of the manuscript can really overwhelm you.
Oh yeah.
So if you take just one little tiny thing and you fix that first, it makes it easier.
That is very good advice and way less overwhelming than just trying to tackle it. Yes. Yes. All right. Very good. So, Marlene, thank you so much for coming on, and we really enjoyed having you. This has been really great. So much good stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a bonus episode of Oh My Word featuring Marlene Perez. For more information about Marlene, please check the episode notes. To like and subscribe to Oh My Word podcast wherever you listen to podcasts for episode updates. And for more information, visit eltenenbaum.com. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.